Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Hello, I'm David Hepworth. You're listening to Word in Your Ear, a series of conversations with music people and music writers. You can subscribe to make sure you get our podcasts at www.wordpodcast.co.uk. Tonight, our guests at the Islington in London, swinging Islington, are Tessa Niles and Gina Foster, two of the UK's most in-demand suppliers of backing vocals, whose joint experience encompasses Live Aid, Stevie Wonder, the Rolling Stones, and advertisements for Cabbage Patch Kids. So on this particular evening, Mark Illan started off by asking Tessa how she got interested in singing.
I think I wanted to be Julie Andrews originally.
Oh, right.
Sound of Music, growing up, watching that, yeah.
I wanted to be a dancer. I still keep thinking they're going to find me out that I'm here being a singer after all these years.
You rumbled.
But yes, Gladys Knight or Kate Bush, even.
Kate Bush.
Yeah.
And when did you first become aware of the concept of the people behind the, you know, the main mic?
Quite early on from Stevie Wonder albums, actually. That was the thing for me, was actually even more important than Stevie himself was what was going on in the background. And it was in the days when you had all the credits on the albums and you could see, oh my gosh, they actually have a name. They're called Wonder Love and they're proper singers. And I was just obsessed. I knew every harmony. I dissected all the vocals and knew, and I know Gina did the same.
My big brother bought us Songs in the Key of Life, because I come from a big family, and he bought us Songs in the Key of Life. And I remember putting on that album right from the beginning, the backing vocals. It's about the voices, and, you know, from the beginning to end, my life was changed after that album. But it starts with backing vocals, that whole
album.
And
a large number of singers started off in the back line, didn't they? You know, Whitney Houston and I think Linda Ronstadt and Lisa Stansfield.
Absolutely. There was a big movement in Newark, New Jersey, actually. For some reason, there must be something in the water there. But a lot of singers came out of there, I guess, through the gospel. Through the churches and Sissy
But they weren't
Houston.
Backing singers, they were singers.
Yeah, they were just singers.
You sang whatever was there to be sung.
So give us an idea of your kind of... The traditional Word in Your Ear question is, what means of playing music was there in your house when you were a child? Yes?
We called it the gram.
The gram.
The gramophone.
Go on, paint us a picture of it. What was it?
Radio.
It was a big... It was a box, you know, about this high. And it had a bit where it kept all the records. Because I'm the youngest of eight, so all my brothers and sisters had their singles, which I wasn't allowed to play, and I'd kind of sneak them on when they weren't home. And they'd come and go, someone's moved my record! So there were things like Otis Redding and, you know, the all the Motown stuff that my brothers and sisters listened to. But, yeah, Sunday was just in the front room, but we called it, playing records.
Standing around the gram. What about you,
Tessa? Yeah, we also had the gram, and we weren't allowed to touch it. My brother can actually kind of testify to that, because we were, you know, because we would always break the needle, and, you know, our dad would come in and just...
That's such a bloke thing. Girls would just get jam on it.
Well, it's true. We did. We did, actually.
Blokes were worried about scratching.
That's right. But we had a lot of Carpenters, a lot of Stevie Wonder, and, yeah, that was our education, along with the Sound of Music.
So when did you start singing and deciding that you could kind of make some kind of a go of it, Tessa?
Yeah, but I watched all of the TV programs, and if we were lucky enough to be taken to any kind of live performance, I wanted to be on the stage. I mean, I was... literally itching to be up there. And I knew I had a, you know, somewhat of an ear for music, but I had no clue how to go about doing it. But I knew that I wanted to be a singer first and foremost. The backing vocal thing came later.
Right. You won a Capital Radio talent contest or something?
Yeah, I won a competition.
Singing what?
Singing Close to You by the Carpenters. Yeah. I did a sort of a multi-tracked version of this thing, and I sang, I think it was 30 seconds, and it was the Golden Lay Egg Company that sponsored it. So I won £20, which was a lot of money in those days, and 20 quid's worth of groceries from my mum.
Superb.
Worth it.
What about you, Gina?
Well, coming from a big family, I'd be in the front room listening to records and singing along, and all my brothers and sisters would be going, "Shut up!" So I never really thought of myself as a singer. I'd try and sing to Gladys Knight, and I couldn't sing like Gladys Knight, so I thought, I can't sing. But then maybe I could sing a bit like, you know, the pop records that everyone listened to Radio 1, so we listened to all kinds of music. But then I was a big David Essex fan. So I would go to David Essex gigs and at 13, and he had The Real Thing as the backing vocalist and Hot Gossip dancers, and I was just fascinated by this stage thing, and I thought, I'm going to be a dancer and an actress. But my last day at school, I went to see Evita, because he was in Evita, and I thought, musicals, if I could sing as well, I could go to musicals. And as a soul ed, I used to go to Tiffany's and Pearly, you know, jazz funk, and we'd always miss the last bus home and have to walk
the plastic palm tree
down this hill. And there was this one house that in this row that was just painted white, had a magnolia tree, and it was, inside you'd see it was all gold brocade and olive green. And at that time, I thought, I'm going to leave school and I'm going to get a job in an office and take some singing lessons. And I bought the stage, and there was a number that was local, and I walked up and it was that house, the singing teacher, and he sent me for auditions, and I just ended up getting gigs as a singer, thinking, okay, maybe I will be a dancer eventually, but it just carried on from there.
Well, so Tessa's book actually has pictures of the groups that you were in, I think.
Oh, Lordy.
Here we go. Yes,
they're called things like Incognita.
Incognita? Well, who are still going strong.
Oh, they're still going?
Oh, yeah, still going strong. They're rather good, but the Shades of Love were definitely Dodge.
You know what's amazing?
Which is the Shades of Love here?
This one.
Right, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So tell us
my first group was Sandy and the Honeys at Caravan Sites in Campersands.
Oh, nice. Very
singing
good.
What kind of numbers?
Singing Top of the World and, you know, all those Carpenter songs, yeah.
Yeah. So tell us about Shades of Love.
Oh, Shades of Love were a fantastic combo. We used to sing some fairly good stuff. We'd do Long Train Running. We'd open up with that. And I seem to remember at the beginning of the show, we had to start it with your arms up. That was the opening of the show, and we were in the Middle East, and something popped out as I was, yeah, not great. But that's a particular memory I have with the Shades of Love. But that was a great opener for me. I mean, I used to do a lot of backing vocals with them, and then, yeah, and some lead stuff as well. It was fun. It was great.
One question I have to ask both of you, actually, that you know, both were professional musicians. Did you go through the same stage that probably most of the people in this room will have gone through, of pretending to sing into a hairbrush or a, I don't
course,
know, whatever?
Definitely. Doesn't everybody?
Constantly, every day.
And in front of a mirror. And when you did it, did you sing or did you just mouth?
No, it was
definitely
singing.
Or did you at one
singing.
Point magically no, burst singing. Into song?
I particularly remember singing along to How Long by Ace. Classic track,
right.
With the hairdryer, and spilt the coffee all over the floor as I was doing it, and had to explain to my mother what the stain was on the carpet and all of that stuff. But we all did it, right? No?
Do you remember there was a magazine that had all the lyrics in? I can't remember what it was called.
What, Smash Hits?
It was before Smash Hits, when I was at
Disco
primary
45.
School.
Disco
45.
Disco 45.
So I would get Disco 45 and I knew the lyrics to all the songs, and I had a best mate and she'd get really annoyed. You know, she'd come back from Spain and say, learn the lyrics to that, because I always knew the lyrics to everything. But I just remember, you know, that was the thing, that just remembering all the lyrics and being able to sing along to the radio, whatever came on, and knowing it all.
Well, we're going to get to the big breaks, which I think, Tessa, in your case, was you started working for recording for ABC, you worked on the Lexicon of Love album, and then got a job on the Police tour, wasn't it? And this is just an amazing bit in your fantastic book, where you go from having had not much experience of it to playing these absolutely colossal venues, and playing right. Shea Stadium, you know, and recording on, you were on Synchronicity, I think.
So you've gone from Shades of Love to, you know...
Pretty much, there was one step in between. I was with a band called Morrissey Mullen.
I don't know if anybody
knows Morrissey Mullen. Fantastic jazz.
Very good group, but probably never played Shea Stadium.
Not to my knowledge, at least they did not invite me. So sadly, no, I didn't get to do it with them. But they used to have a regular gig at the Half Moon in Putney, I think it was. So I sang with them for a year. And then one afternoon I got a call saying... Can you get down to a rehearsal studio? I can't tell you who it's for, but they're going on tour and it's a big band. And I was like, hang on a second, I'll just check the diary. Lying, you know, it was nothing in it whatsoever. And got in a taxi, donned the ripped jeans and the stripy T-shirt and, you know, and the big shoulder pads. And went down to the rehearsal studio and still didn't know who it was who I was going to meet. And... when I got inside, I could hear the strains that were barely being contained by the steel doors, and I realised it was the Police. And so I took a minute to compose myself and then opened this gigantic steel door and walked in, and there was Sting and Andy Summers and Stuart Copeland, and there was me sort of shaking, thinking, what the hell do I do now?
And but how did they identify you? How did you get the call from them? How did they find out about you?
I think it came from a lady... This is really long-winded, but it came from a lady called Marsha Hunt.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Who knew my then-husband.
Mick Jagger's.
Pal of Mick Jagger's, and I think mother of one of his children.
Absolutely, yeah.
And, it came through her. So thanks, Marsha.
And so what did you have to do for the Police? You know, what did you... Sorry. Now, please note, the dirty laugh didn't come from me.
No.
What was you required to do here?
Yeah, well, I was very intimidated. I mean, there were three bona fide rock stars standing in front of me, and I was genuinely very, very frightened. And I didn't do anything, actually, there. Thank goodness. I just introduced myself, and Sting said, look, I'm having a bit of a sing-song in a couple of days at my house. Would you like to come round? Yes, OK. All right, yes.
But you had an instruction, didn't you? There was no vibrato and full power all the time.
Yeah.
Is that right? Which I think is really interesting. And the other interesting thing is that he wanted backing vocalists to cover the lead vocal. So you had to sing, one of you had to sing the melody the whole time to give his voice a rest, which I never realized that's often our job, isn't it?
Yeah. It's the story of our lives in a way that I think on that particular huge tour, they knew that it was going to be, or the management knew that Sting's voice was going to take a beating. So they took a chance and took singers with them so that he could sometimes relax a little bit on his lead vocals, and the backing vocalists would sort of take over and sing the melody or the harmonies. But it almost never worked out like that, because he would just sing full tilt the whole time. But it was a fantastic experience, but I almost lost my voice.
It's a bizarre idea that you paid that money to go and see Sting, and in fact you're not hearing Sting. You know,
yes,
I know.
Exactly.
You're hearing somebody else.
Exactly. But you've been backing singers during a time when live performance has changed a lot, hasn't it? You know, that it's become a lot more demanding. You know, people play for longer, now that they tour for longer. I mean, it's physically very, very demanding, isn't it, Gina?
It is. I mean, you've got to learn not to sleep and things like that, be up all night and get on a bus and, you know, be
flying. But at the same time, you've got to preserve
your
instrument.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's so much of... You kind of want to keep up with everyone and do what everyone else is doing, you know, naughty things that people do, but then you have to go to bed because you've got to, you know... all of how you feel shows in your voice.
But this is it. I remember Robert Plant saying to me that, you know, trying to pretend that he didn't get too involved in all the bad things that went on with Led Zeppelin, which was nonsense. But he said, well, I couldn't really, because if you're a drummer or a guitarist or a bass player, you know, you can stay up all night and you can still go out and play. But if you're the singer, it's going to show, isn't it?
Yeah, it's because this is such a fragile instrument. Built in, so you know it's handy, but that's about where it, you know, where it finishes. You've got to take care of it. You can't do the copious amounts of drugs and alcohol.
I did a gig the other day for the first time in all the years that I've been singing. I woke up, I had no voice. And I had not been in that position before. And I thought, what am I going to do? I had to go to the rehearsal, had the gig the next day. I could not even speak. But somehow the adrenaline kicks in, and I just took everything that I could. And I got through the gig, and no one noticed that I had lost my voice. I couldn't speak afterwards. But somehow it just gets you going.
I think
the adrenaline.
They call it doctor theatre, don't they?
Is that in
theatrical circles, I think.
Okay.
Now, I'm not going to be afraid to ask really dumb questions here, okay? Explain a harmony to me.
Well, so you...
Demonstrate.
One of the things you have to remember is that I think some of the times we don't get the respect that we might deserve.
Well,
because
now's your opportunity.
I have never had any classical training, so I do it all by ear. So when you ask me what a harmony is, I know thirds and fifths and blah, 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 but I can do it, but I can't always tell you how to do it.
Sing us a third and then a fifth. Let's sing us a third. To demonstrate the two.
A third? Well, you have to know what the melody is.
Well, one of you can sing a melody.
Pick a song.
Sing a third on the top.
What were we going to do? What should we sing? Oh. Three, four. Sweet dreams are made of this. Who am I to disagree? I travel. Okay, so that's the melody,
that's
right?
The
we all
melody.
Know that's
right.
The melody.
That's the melody.
Well, that's low, isn't it? Annie wouldn't
she's
sing
always
it
chickening
that
out,
way.
Yeah.
Sweet dreams are made of this. Who am I to disagree? I travel the world and the seven seas. Everybody's looking for something.
Very good.
Fantastic. And what about vibrato and non-vibrato? We can imagine, give us something without vibrato, then put the vibrato on.
Go on.
Well, yeah, vibrato is basically it's a wobble. Yeah. It's the wobble that kind of Sting doesn't like it. Although, funnily enough, he sings with it, but he doesn't like anybody else to sing with it. Anyway, it's the wobble, and it helps you stay in tune, doesn't it, Gina?
Yeah, I mean, there's certain singers like Sade. She doesn't sing with vibrato, so she can sound out of tune, but it's part of her sound. Your love is king. It can sound a bit weird, but if you sing, your love is king.
Brilliant. I got that. Now, there's a lot more vibrato around nowadays, isn't there? Is that fair to say?
It's not called vibrato.
Go on.
It's called melisma.
Right, go on. And tell us about that then. Come on.
And I hate it, so I'm not going to demonstrate.
Demonstrate satirically if you like.
I'll go back and tell you another story about.
Go on, right,
so much of what we've done as singers, people come up and say, "How do you get to be a singer?" And how did I have no idea because it's always happened by accident. Coming from that singing teacher, I got a gig with a group called the Flirtations.
Oh right.
Who had kind of been around in the 60s and they'd stayed, and one of the singers had gone off, and they needed a new girl. So at 17, I was singing with these two grown women. Bit like the Supremes, you know. You might know who the Flirtations are. But they were always on Will Tappers and Shunters and, David Nixon and all that. So they would go down and round and do the Chicken in a Basket circuit, Wakefield Theatre Club, Batfield Variety and all that. So I got to a point where I thought...
Nothing wrong with Wakefield Theatre Club.
No, it was wonderful. Great education. And then I thought, this isn't going anywhere, you know. So, and I'd always been told, get a proper job, you know, you've got to learn a craft. So I had a boyfriend who was a hairdresser and I went and worked in a hairdresser's to train as a hairdresser. I left. And that was on Duke Street. And thought I could sing in the evening, but it was such hard work, I didn't sing in the evening. It just, hairdressing took over. And then I got a call one day, and they said, well, can you come and meet this person? Because someone wants to write us a song, and maybe you want to come back. And I said, no, I'm not doing singing at the moment. They said, no, just come to the Athenaeum Hotel in Piccadilly, which was a walk away. So I said, okay. So I went down there and met them after work, and we were sitting in the bar for like 2 hours. I'm sitting there, you know, thinking, okay, I'm going now. They said, no, another 5 minutes, he's going to be here. And I turned around, and there was Stevie Wonder standing in the doorway, who is actually really tall. I guess because you always see him sitting down, I always imagined he was short. So I thought, oh my God, there's Stevie Wonder. And then he walks over to our table, and I'm I remember that when they came over in the 60s, they toured with Stevie Wonder, and he was a friend of theirs. So he came over and said, "Hi, girls, you know, sorry, you know." We went up to his room, and he took me aside, and he said, "You know, these are my friends, and I want to write a song for them, and, you know, will you come back?" And I'm like, okay. So I got back into singing, otherwise I'd be a hairdresser if it wasn't for Stevie Wonder. Yeah. So, but in that time, we would go to his, after work, I'd go to his hotel room, and he was trying to find a song for us. And he had like boxes of cassettes with just amazing songs, and Wonder Love were there singing the songs. He'd say, "Alex, you know, sing this one." And he couldn't quite find the song. And one, he would disappear in the bathroom, no sense of time, be on the phone for ages. And then one day he came out and just wrote this song. Said, "Shirley, sing this, Gina, sing this," and he did this song. But while I was working with them, they would do all these, they would get Indian music and practice all these scales. So that's where that, all that came from. People like him wanted to sound all the intricate little microtones and all that. They would practice this, and it was got into gospel music, and then it got into R&B, and then pop copies this, and everyone sings like that now because... and it's also to do with the technology, because it's all auto-tuned and they use the computer to perfect everything, so it's much easier to if someone sings out of tune, you can fix
it. Partly that kind of vocal gymnastics, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
Whitney Houston,
but also the music doesn't have chord progressions anymore.
Yeah.
It's copy and paste. You know, if you listen to a Steely Dan record, it goes somewhere.
Yeah.
So you can shape your vocal, but now it's the same at the beginning as it is at the end. What do you do?
You mean they're actually dropping in exactly the same vocal?
Same track. Yeah.
But with the same vocal as well, so it's identical.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So what do you have to make the vocal interesting, so they do vocal gymnastics to make it...
So are you like me, you know, that you sit there and watch the Saturday night TV talent show where some kind of moppet is kind of over-emoting some...
I don't watch...
And think to yourself, that's overdoing it. You know, that's not singing. That's just showing off.
Yeah, I think for us, definitely, there is that sense of just tell the story, sing the song, you know, connect...
Yeah.
with the audience, instead of kind of going off and singing, you know, doing the vocal gymnastics.
Would you say Bob Dylan is a good singer?
Yes.
Well, yes. Yeah.
If he went on The Voice, he wouldn't get through.
He wouldn't get round to pass.
He's
round
uniquely
one.
Bob Dylan. It's the fact that he doesn't
or
sound
Nina
like
Simone.
Anybody else. Is
Nina all, Simone yeah. wouldn't have had a career today.
No,
would
absolutely.
She?
No.
So moving on,
These are various people you've worked with and or recorded with, and pick any one of those to talk about the way they work. I don't know.
Well, it would have
Suede
to be.
Suede is a brilliant bit in the book where there's tremendous friction.
Yeah,
Tessa, when you're in the studio with them and they're not getting on.
No, they weren't getting on at all.
So backing singers must see a lot of this from the inside.
Well, they do. I mean, we're sort of privy to a lot of stuff that goes on, whether it's in the studio or on the road. You know, you're part of the inner sanctum. You're not the band, but you're just the next sort of closest
thing. Because
the police
were warring when you were working.
Oh, something about when I work with people, they seem to be warring.
Stop.
I'm worried about that. Yeah, the police were pretty much about to split up when we did this last Synchronicity tour. And they were just at each other's throats. They were physical with each other. They didn't like each other. They had three separate limousines, one each to take them, you know, hither and thither, because they really didn't want to be in each other's company. It was coming to an end. So that was sad.
And when you're thrown into these band situations, do you have to very, very quickly work out what you can do and what you can't do?
Oh, absolutely.
Totally. There's a lot of psychology that goes with it. And
absolutely. I mean, I think there is used to be a perception, perhaps there isn't so much anymore, that, you know, clearly one of the band had to have been shagging the backing singer, because, you know, that was just kind of the way it worked in the 60s and 70s. But by the time we'd got in, it was all too serious and we weren't allowed to do
we
that anymore.
Out.
I love weren't allowed. Who made sure
just,
that?
Well, the thing was, that's why there were groupies, because groupies took care of that side of things, and we were part of the band, and you know, we kind of didn't mix business and pleasure. Can I say that?
But I got the impression also that you were the kind of social glue to some extent, in that nobody falls out with the backing singer. Nobody's going to be upstaged by the backing.
No, the backing singers just fall out with each other.
Oh, they fall out with each other. They probably do. Does that get competitive? Yeah. No, but I got the impression that the bands will confide in the backing singer.
I think so. Because we're no threat.
Yeah.
We're no threat, and we're genuinely kind of quite jolly, happy people. And I think that's one of the reasons we're around. Also, is to make that atmosphere. conducive for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let me choose one of these for you. The Stones. You were on Steel Wheels, weren't you, Tessa? I mean, what's that? What's it like recording with the Stones?
Yeah. Strange.
Are you ever in the same room as them?
Yeah, actually, I think a lot of people don't realise that recording is done in different stages. And so very often, I mean, for instance, I worked on What's Love Got to Do With It with Tina Turner, but she wasn't there. So I didn't get to meet her, but I sang on the record and did that. But with the Stones, they were definitely there. Yeah.
Yeah. How could you tell?
Well, Keith was doing his Keith thing, and Mick was being Mick, just kind of strutting up. I mean, he was being classically Mick, strutting up and down. I think he had a girlfriend on the phone, and you know he was, you know, involved in some kind of drama. And he was just completely, fabulously, wonderfully Mick.
And you must be really tempted in situations like that to just not concentrate on the work. You just want to listen to what's going on, don't you? And because you must go home and, you know, somebody says, go on, what was so-and-so like? And you
well,
must
that's
have
why
something...
I wrote a book.
Yeah, OK, fine. Fair enough.
Often they're just people, aren't they? They're not actually as interesting as you might think, so...
But here it's a wide range of different kinds of acts, you know. So in working with ABC, you know, Trevor Horn, Lexicon of Love, that's very kind of delicate, micro-managed stuff, isn't it? Are you working on the same bit for ages with that kind of production?
Yeah, I mean, I'm casting my mind back to it now, and it was... there was a lot of guesswork, I think... I think the whole thing when you're in the studio, the producer kind of wants to throw a few different things at you, and you try things in different ways. You know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I think you just have to be incredibly flexible.
How does the guide vocal business work? Because that's fascinating. But, you know, because when it's a bit where Nicole Kidman and Robbie Williams made a record together, and you do Nicole Kidman's vocal for her, don't you? A basic idea of what the producer's looking for.
Yeah.
So are you instructed on a certain way to sing, or is that your interpretation of how it ought to be, or are you impersonating the singer that you're meant to be laying the thing down for?
I think a bit of everything. I think when you go into the studio and do a guide vocal, if you know it's not for you, the song isn't for you, and it's for somebody else, you wouldn't do any particular vocal trickery on it.
Often the reason you're called in is because you're getting someone who's not a singer. They don't actually know how to sing a song that someone hasn't sung before. That's why people do covers, because someone's nailed the vocal,
right,
and then they can just copy. Yeah. But if you're going into a song that hasn't been sung, I remember doing a session for a writer, and he just had the melody, and Lulu was doing the lyrics, and I had to go in and sing, I don't know, which turned out to be, I don't really want to fight, no. You know, so you kind of...
They
give
stole
the initial
ad-libs.
So you create...
it must be fantastic.
You create the music really, don't you?
Yeah, you've always got an input into... That's why you get called.
Are there any big hits where you can actually say to people when they're on, that is precisely... Give us an example of that one.
Yeah, there was a song, a track I did for Duran Duran.
Oh, right.
And I was given the melody. I didn't write the melody, but it was... I kind of interpreted it, shall we say, and it was a song called Come Undone, which was actually a top 10 hit in the US.
So Simon Le Bon followed your vocal...
Well, actually, no, he actually took himself out and just left me on the track.
Oh, right.
So it's a little bit more like... It's not quite a duet, but it's, yeah. It's
but you just get paid the session fee.
Sadly, yes.
Right.
The Duran Duran section in your book is absolutely hilarious. She talks about them wearing guyliner on stage.
They literally wore more makeup than I did.
And of all the party animals that you're talking about, they are the most over the top. I mean, a Duran Duran tour is completely... Give us some idea of just how over the top these guys are.
Yeah, they're fairly over the top. They are the ultimate party band, and they live to party. And we were doing a gig at the... We were opening the Hard Rock Hotel in Vegas, so you can imagine. And it was crazy. It was just insane. And of course, they have all these celebrity friends, and so people show up after the show, and it's all wonderful, and they just love it. And they're still doing it now, and they're in their 50s. So, yeah.
Well, that picture there with Stevie and me in the middle was actually, you know, you just got a call one day, can you come and do a session at Westway in Flavrock Grove? and it turned out to be a Stevie Wonder session. There's Carol Thompson down the bottom, who David Rodigan would know, and Paul Johnson, and he actually wrote the song while we were there. He hadn't written the song. Everyone came in, and everyone was like, oh, my God, it's Stevie Wonder, and he just sat and played whatever favourite tune people wanted to hear, and then he wrote the song, and we did the BBs on the spot.
I love the way people work like that. Elton John's exactly the same. Yeah, somebody's booked in to record the song at 12 o'clock that he hasn't written at 11 o'clock.
No.
And apparently it makes you, too, because it's quite a lot of money, isn't it? You know, ticking up, you know.
Absolutely.
It makes you get on with it, you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
But now, some of the things you do are, you know, occasionally, you know, not legendary, you know, musicians. They might involve the advertising of the Cabbage Patch doll or the Kinder Egg.
And your first one was for the Meat Marketing Board, was that right?
Yes, it was for the Meat Marketing Board.
So what do you have to sing for the Meat
Marketing
Board?
I can't remember
the jingle was.
I can't remember the jingle, but I remember it very well because I had braces on my teeth. And I think I had to say, it was something about stewing steak. And I had terrible problems saying stewing steak. I could barely get my mouth around it. So, yeah, that one was memorable.
And so do you get called upon to do things that are speech as well as music, do you, for commercials? Does that happen?
Yeah. I used to do the very speeded up bit at the end of the advert, you know, and batteries not included, each doll sold separately.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, the disclaimers. That
yeah,
must be...
Exactly. For Barbie, I was the voice of Barbie for a long time, yeah.
And how does Barbie sound?
Barbie sounds like this. Yeah. She's really sweet, and she doesn't come with any batteries.
Very good.
You weren't the voice of Bodyform, were you? Do you remember that?
No.
That was huge. Oh.
Bodyform is the best advert, isn't it?
It is astonishing. Everyone was talking about it.
Yeah. How does Stevie Langer?
It was you.
It wasn't me. Yeah.
How does that one go? I don't know.
Oh, God. I don't think I dare.
Wow, Bodyform.
Oh, you there?
Oh, no, it's a classic. It's the absolute, absolute classic.
But the point is, you might turn up and you don't know what the product is, like you didn't know whether it was the police or whatever. And they just go, Kinder Eggs, you know, go. And you just have to get into the Kinder Egg space, do you? Just
yeah, I was told, could I sound a bit more green?
Right. I can imagine. Yeah. I can imagine. Yeah. Okay, so it's a useful skill.
But we put these in because they're just so fascinating, what you had to say about both of these guys. I mean, George Harrison, there's a bit where you tell you how he ruined his voice on the Dark Horse Tour, I think it was. And I remember I've seen a documentary of this, and he has all these potions that he has to drink before he goes on stage. So he really did shred his voice, didn't he? And couldn't perform.
Yeah,
for quite a long time.
I mean, I think so many singers do, don't they, Gina? They just, it's so rigorous, the whole thing about singing and touring and singing night after night. And you know, you're not about to kind of do a nice, quiet little vocal. You're going to give it full tilt every night.
You don't realise at the time the damage you're doing. It's accumulative, so. You know, once you've torn a little bit and then sing on top of that, over the years, it just disappears.
But don't they worry that it might never come back? You know, people lost their voices. Paul Young lost his voice, didn't he?
We don't hear
Paul Young anymore because he simply lost his voice about 15 years ago.
He's still gigging, but it's a struggle.
And, you know, still gigging. Roger,
he's
still
gigging. He just mimes.
But no one can hear him.
Yeah, it's very quiet. Yeah, intimate evenings.
No, people have terrible problems and lose their voices. I mean, Adele lost her voice. She had to have vocal surgery, so did Sam Smith.
Annie Lennox.
That's right, Sam Smith.
Roger
Daltrey constantly worrying about not being able to hit the top notes, and Robert Plant can't, and Paul McCartney now can't.
Yeah. So Bob Dylan's at an advantage, isn't he?
Yeah, huge advantage, as is Leonard Cohen.
Do you kind of monitor your own voices? You know, do you go to vocal?
No, I think you just learn yourself. You have to be aware of your own body. Yeah. Just shut up for the day.
Yeah, and also I think there's a thing that more experienced singers can do, which is basically sing quieter, because they know that if they carry on singing at full tilt, particularly in something like a rehearsal where you don't need to sing at full tilt, so you just pull it back and you think, okay, I'm going to have to save this a bit. But younger singers coming up don't know how to do that. You know, they just don't know the breadth of what their voice can and can't do.
Is as a lead singer, you can work a way around it. But if you're doing BVs, you've got to do what you've been told to do. You can't change because you're singing with other people. You know.
One question I wanted to ask you, it pretty much relates to talking about guide vocals and things like this. The records are built up you know, layer by layer nowadays, aren't they? And, you know, there's all kinds of mixing desks, far more sophisticated than the one we've got over there. And I always think, if I'm at my concert and there's three backing singers there and there's the lead singer, I always think, somebody is mixing this so that they...
There's a thing called Pro Tools.
Yes, go on.
Which there is a backing track. A lot of the, especially pop gigs, there are backing vocals on track and the singers sing on top. So mostly it's just visual, the singers that are there. Sorry to disappoint you.
But no, but in fact, I mean, it's beyond that, though. It's when Madonna used to play and we can legally say this, Madonna used to have an entire thing on the synth.
Janet Jackson and all those. In fact, Michael Jackson did. Yeah. It was on Synclavier, but only because he was dancing, and a lot of the time he did sing.
And Madonna's answer was, which do you want? Do you want Madonna to sing, or do you want her to dance? Because you can't do both.
It's very interesting. So, but
there are singers. I mean, Lady Gaga sings live and dances. She's amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether you like her or not, she's...
No, it makes a big point, the fact she does that quite rightly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think, you know, for us as backing vocalists, we've always felt that there's a perception also sometimes amongst people who see backing singers. You know, they see them in their little black dresses and and their little shimmy and the whole thing. And they're not quite sure why they're there. Are they there for the glamour? Are they there to add the vocal support? And
all of those things.
All of that. Yeah, well, exactly. And it is all of those things. And I think there is a perception that somehow backing singers might be like failed lead singers somehow. They just haven't made it as performers, and so that's why they're backing vocalists. But for us, it was a major choice. It was like, actually, we love this. This is what we're best at.
Right.
So
we're starting a documentary that we're making, because there was 20 Feet from Stardom, which I didn't watch for ages because I hate the title, because it's like, oh, you didn't quite make it to the front spot, you know. But I've had a solo career. Well, I haven't done as many sessions as Tessa, because in the heyday, I was in America, Paisley Park studio, recording my own album. I embarked on a solo career, which didn't work out. I had a baby, and you have to have that drive, you know, and I lost the drive. But it wasn't like I'm, you know, didn't quite make it, because I love doing BVs. It's a whole different skill that we isn't appreciated until, like you say.
But also,
if you walk in and you put the parts together yourself, because you know how to do that.
And there's something intensely attractive in the book when you talk about the lack of responsibility and that you've got to go on stage and all that, but you're not.
You can walk down the street afterwards.
You can walk down the street afterwards, you know. And then there's this terrible transition, which all musicians have, going from, as you say, put it, from rock chick to housewife, from limos to Tesco's. And suddenly you're on tour and everyone's doing everything for you, the centre of attention. Then you've got to go home.
That's right.
I remember feeling.
Clean,
I was doing a gig with Annie Lennox that we did a live recording at Hammersmith Lyric, and I came out and there was the limo and these people all standing there going, Gina, and I was like, oh, I didn't like it. I got home to my house in Chiswick and was quite pleased that there was no one at my doorstep. Yeah. I could just go in and there's no one peeking through the window or hiding under the bed.
Yeah. One of the occupational hazards of female backing singers is the frock, isn't it?
Yeah.
The outfit.
The frock.
Well,
black
usually
frock.
In an outfit, isn't
Are you
there?
Told what to wear?
It's decided. Yeah.
Black is the uniform, yes.
Because when your police tour, you were wearing kind of long... How would we describe them?
Well, they were like full Arab outfit. I don't know how else to describe it.
I don't
think
you'd do it. You wouldn't be done nowadays, would
no,
it?
Definitely not now. No. Not rocking up to a gig in full burqa and thing. Yeah.
But is it kind of like being a bridesmaid, you know, that you've kind of fear the frock? Do you? What's somebody going to turn up with that I'm going to have to wear?
Well, that's the other thing they say, always the bridesmaid about the backing vocals. Because you're not allowed to draw focus. You know, the focus. Yeah. I remember I did the first Jules Holland Hootenanny, because I was working with Chuck Demons and Pliers and Sly and Robbie, so we were on that. And then they needed BV, so we ended up doing Sting and Dina Carroll. And I knew some of the people that were doing Dina Carroll, and we were like, you know, give us a gig. And they said, no, because you'd pull focus. She can't have backing vocals like you on stage.
See, there's another thing about security, you know, artists feeling insecure, perhaps. Female artists possibly feeling insecure having other women backing them.
Whereas you get Tina Turner, who will have the hottest backing vocalists, because she can. No competition.
She's always done that, hasn't she?
Yeah.
You know, for a long, long time. Yeah. We'll flip over that one, I think.
We've done Duran Duran, but I was just interested in the idea of huge crowds.
Yes.
Thing, I mean, how do you see a crowd that big? Can you feel the reaction?
But you don't see... This is more intimidating than that.
Yeah, probably.
You know, when you're playing Shea Stadium and there's tiny little pinpricks of people, and you don't, they're not really people, are they? It's
like, but you must have some times when you don't have anything to do and you're on stage.
Yes. Like,
do you?
Yes.
And are you amusing yourself by having a look round the crowd? Yes?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Checking out the people who in the front row, because
that's
they're,
not
they're
his
fantastic.
Wife. You know, all that.
Yeah.
And you can, because you think no one's looking night. At you. You think everyone's looking at the main person, and you're having a stare. Can you see what she's wearing down the front?
Right, right. So you keep yourself amused.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Most definitely. But the thing is, you can't go off, you know, you can't go off for too long, because you've got to come in back in with your,
right.
your chorus parts and
right.
your stuff, you know.
We were talking earlier, you said that nobody does Sha-la-la anymore, do they? Or, you know.
I can't remember the last time I was asked to sing Sha-la-la or Wham-a-lama-ding-dong.
Because there must have been somebody who originally wrote Wham-a-lama-ding-dong,
exactly.
wasn't there?
Yeah. Exactly.
But you were saying, Gina, you tried some of this. The other day,
I think really it's because backing vocalists don't get asked to do the BVs. They're, nowadays, everyone wants to be in control. You've got, you know, there's one guy making the music, and he thinks he knows everything because he can play the bass on a keyboard, he can play the drums with his fingers, and so he will do the BVs arrangement, not really knowing what's possible. So if he asks me, then I will do those things. I'll show him the scope of what is possible within a song. But you know,
can you think of any songs that were made by the backing vocals? We were talking about Walk on the Wild Side.
Joe Cocker. Help
yeah.
with My Friends.
Yeah.
What would that be without the BVs?
Yeah.
Respect.
Yeah.
R-E-S-P-E-C-T.
Oh, right. Yes.
Yeah.
Midnight Train
just
to Georgia.
Just a little bit. I mean, you know, they're kind
of classic.
Well,
those Aretha Franklin records were made around the backing vocals. They're all sisters,
that's
weren't
right.
they?
Yeah, that's right.
So it was effectively a
It's
kind
a very
of
much
person.
A part of the song, isn't it?
Yeah,
I think the thing about BVs is that why they're so important in record making is that they take a part of the song that you want, the hook, and they turn it into this kind of magical part that is, it just leaps out of the track and just...
It draws the audience in, because that's the bit that you sing along to, isn't it?
Yeah, you might not remember the verse, but you're certainly going to listen to and remember the chorus, because it's so hammered home by the backing vocals.
Because you're kind of encouraging the audience to sing along, aren't you?
Exactly.
Yeah, right, okay. That's the kind of classic function of the chorus, I suppose.
That's it.
What have we got here?
Just more people. It was the people you work with. I mean, Robbie Williams is a wonderful story. You do the tour with Robbie Williams and, you know, you've played Nebworth and all that stuff. And then suddenly he just rings you up and announces that he's going to give you a large cash bonus.
Yeah.
So I thought it was astonishing. That can't happen very often.
Not very
and
often.
A very substantial amount of money comes down the pipe.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember it well because I was sitting in Pizza Hut with a whole load of kids and other mums and stuff, and took a call from Robbie's management, and it was Robbie would like to give you a gift,
and
I had mozzarella kind of dripping on, and I was like, what? Yeah, it was extraordinary, and he's very generous. He's incredibly, he's wonderful to work for.
Because the quantities of cash makes you realise, you know, when you're playing a stadium, the colossal amounts of cash being, even though you're all staying in these fabulous hotels, all that, the amount of money being earned is ludicrous.
No, it's massive.
So that's great.
Yeah.
Although a lot of artists make their money from live things now, so that
absolutely.
I think, rather than records, so there's not so much of that cash flowing to the lesser mortals.
Is it generally a well-paid, you know, profession?
I think... A lot of gigs now pay the same as when we were around in the 80s, which is, you know, it's not trickling up anymore. Because people don't sell the...
It's like journalism.
Yeah. I'm shocked, actually, what young people get paid, because they don't actually know what we got paid.
Yeah.
So they will go and do a gig in Serbia for 120 quid, you know, get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, get dropped off at Hammersmith, you know, at 4 a.m. and find your way home, whereas we had cars to pick us up.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, I think every industry has seen that decline. Yeah. So particularly, yeah.
But I suppose this would be, you know, one of the higher points. When was the Prince's Trust?
Yes, indeed.
Show?
Look
show
at some
was this?
Good people there. There's Leonard Cohen there. There's Howard Jones. Midge Ure, the Bee Gees, Phil Collins.
Peter Gabriel,
Brian May.
Young,
oh, my word. Mark Knopfler. That strange guy from Wet, Wet, Wet.
In what way strange?
He smiles a lot.
Well, I think he made a serious error in judgment, which I'm sure he would probably even admit to. He tried to out-sing Joe Cocker on that gig.
OSC.
Yeah, not great.
So do you notice these things? You're at the back of the stage and you're thinking, oh, let's push that too far. And you haven't got to let your face betray your emotions, presumably.
Yeah, absolutely.
You've just got to keep...
Keep poised, keep...
Do you have standard movements that you do?
Oh, yes. Go on, step, you know.
What's it called? What are you doing? The backing vocal dance. Go on, let's see.
You have to do it with me.
Do it together.
Everybody knows the backing vocal.
This is really going to work on the podcast.
How do we do this?
How do we do this? We've got to have an imaginary beat.
That's it.
Right, okay. It's very good.
It took us years to perfect that.
It's like Marcel Marceau on radio. Really on the podcast.
It's a kind of amble, isn't it? You can't afford to go too far because you're going to drop off the...
You've got to get back to the mic.
Yeah, you can't.
The backing singers are always constantly catching the attention of other members of the band, smiling at them and keeping that connection going, which is a very important part of
the vibe going. Yeah, very.
This is just a brilliant section in the book where you, Tessa, are hired by... This is a fantastic scratch band, isn't it? I mean, it's Thomas Dolby, wasn't it? Stephen Armstrong, I think.
Absolutely.
Matthew Seligman. I mean, these guys, they just put together this really young band to play Live Aid. And, you know, you're flown in a helicopter and David Bowie can't stand being flown and all this sort of stuff. And there's a brilliant bit where he says something like, what should we play? And you say, what about Rebel Rebel? He goes, brilliant idea. I mean, I'm sure it was on the song.
I think it might have been on the list anyway. But I made you feel thrilled.
Like you chose it, you know. But what was it like being out there and seeing that?
Oh, well, I mean, just look at the size of that crowd and look at the weather.
The weather, yeah. Absolutely.
Look at the size of the crowd. And it was only when we were there, to be honest with you, that we realised how big this thing was. It was only when you stepped out on the stage and went, oh my God, and saw everybody backstage and we thought, okay, this is big. This is bigger than we've ever done. And it was extraordinary. It was one of the few occasions where I've had an artist ask me what I was wearing. What I was thinking of wearing on the gig.
Well, rather than telling you what to wear.
Or rather than just, you know, the little black dress, which is normally the kind of uniform that we have. And I was so impressed because I thought, this is a guy that's really interested in the visuals as well as the sound. It's the full package.
And had you decided what you were going to wear at that point that he asked you?
No, not at all. We said, what are you wearing?
Oh, right.
And he said, well, I'm wearing a little powder blue
number
outfit.
So I don't want to clash.
And I said, aha, okay. And myself and the other lady, Helena Springs, decided that we would compliment him with a little blue outfit of our own.
Right. Shoulder pads are go-go there, aren't they?
Oh, massive.
Yeah, absolutely.
Massive. There's actually another backing singer.
We were just talking about Butler
and
Wilson brooches. You know, big Butler and Wilson jewellery that we used to wear.
And you were on Dancing on the Street, weren't you? The Jagger Bowie single. Did you record that with them too? Well, probably not.
They'd already done their bits. It was another classic example of didn't meet the artist in the studio.
Yeah.
We were routining the Live Aid concert, and then we just got a call to say, "Can you come down? And we're going to sing this song and did the BVs on it." Yeah. So it was great. It's great, you know, to actually sort of walk into a supermarket now and hear Dancing in the Street and think, yeah.
Do you nudge people in the queue?
Sometimes I do.
I wouldn't be able to resist.
Actually,
there's a mad woman keeps bothering me, pretending she's on it.
Pretending she's on it. Yeah.
I was touring with ABC last year, and it was just weird that I was doing, I was being Tessa Niles.
Oh, right, you were singing her back.
That's right.
So the two of you have come together to do these, you're doing a show this week as unsung singers. So go on, tell us a bit about that.
We've decided that it's about time we got a bit of credit, or not just us, but backing vocals in general. Well, one of the things I noticed when there's a classics album series. Do you know them? They did Asia. They did Songs in the Key of Life. And I sat there with bated breath waiting for them to talk about the BVs, and they didn't talk about the BVs at all and never even mentioned them. So we've decided to start telling the story about backing vocalists and the songs that they sang on, because they don't always get credits. So that's what this night at the Olympic Barnes, we're going to be going through the history where it all kind of started back in the 50s.
That's on Thursday.
Yeah.
That's right. But if you listen to the podcast, it's already passed. But will people get further opportunities to see this?
This is our first one. There will be more, definitely.
Right. Yeah. And it's the two of you plus a piano player, or...?
Mike Moran. Do you remember Mike Moran?
Right.
Yeah, he was Rock Bottom.
Rock Bottom with the Jackie DeChanel.
He also played the intro to Nobody Does It Better, and
Right.
So he's our orchestra.
And what songs do you sing?
Are we going to give it away? We were going to the 90s, and there's so much to talk about, and so it's 60s, 70s. So we do things like a bit of Dusty, you know,
bit of Cilla
or Downtown.
Step Inside, you know. Love. You
Step Inside,
Inside yeah, Love. Yeah. We're doing
wrong.
That.
Can't See, go wrong.
We made a good choice.
Step Inside, Love. And then we
Help with My Friends.
Yeah. Which they're all songs that really feature backing vocals.
Kiki. Yes.
Yeah.
Excellent.
I got the music in me. Yeah.
So, and you hope to, you know, eventually involve other backing singers in this, so you could rise
up
two, like
we a... We have got two other, Keith Morrell and Mim Gray, are with us, who are both noted backing vocalists.
Yeah, and then eventually the plan is that we get really well-known backing vocalists who actually also had solo careers. So people like Madeline Bell.
P.P. Arnold. And
P.P. Arnold.
Linda Lewis.
Yeah. Who are incredible. And also celebrate the fact that they don't try and sort of hide the fact that they were backing vocalists. They really... It was a big part of their own history. So we'd get them in and have them as guest singers and... You know, just celebrate the whole British music, really.
Very exciting. So that starts this week, and there'll be, you know, watch press for details of
further
shows.
And we must mention this fantastic book.
And this is Tessa's book, Backtrack, The Voice Behind Music's Greatest Stars, which Tessa would be very happy to sign for you, I'm sure.
Very happy to sign.
There are large numbers of copies available.
Out there. We're going to take a break, and now we'll be back with David Rodigan soon. But meanwhile, please say thank you to Tessa Niles and Gina Foster.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.